thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 86, recorded Friday, May 11th, 2012. Ya big mook. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. We are at episode 86, and we are joined by Dan Cohen of dancohen.org. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Amanda.
Mills Kelly of edwired.org. Hello, Mills.
Hello, hello.
And we are not joined this week by Tom Scheinfeldt of foundhistory.org, but we do have a very special guest, Audrey Waters, who is an education technology journalist who can be found at hackeducation.com, and she also blogs under that rubric at Inside Higher Ed. Hello, Audrey.
Hello, everybody.
Great to have you with us. So we're at the end of the semester, which is always, I haven't been teaching, and so I'm not as engaged in that kind of rhythm as I have been in the past, but Mills and Dan, have you been seeing any particular good student work here at the end of the semester? Anything in particular that stands out?
Well, I'll go first and just say that some of you may remember that I'm teaching my Lying About the Past course this semester, and so my students have been perpetrating historical internet hoaxes, two of them, in fact. And to my surprise, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but the one that I thought was the better of the two hoaxes got no traction, and the one which I thought was probably slightly weaker has gotten a fair amount of traction, not maybe to the same degree that the last American pirate did a few years ago, but all will be revealed on Monday. So depending on when, this coming Monday, depending on when this podcast goes up, it'll either be already revealed or soon to be revealed. So I've been really enjoying that. They've done some really remarkable work.
You know, Mills, this past week, there was this story about Abe Lincoln inventing Facebook. And I was sort of semi-joking around with people on Twitter that, maybe this was something that came out of your class. But it was just way too obvious, right? I mean, that was the whole point of your class is about historical hoaxes have to have some kind of verisimilitude, which often includes subtlety, right? Or
right.
Some way of I loved the video that one of your students took in the last American pirate hoax where they visited some old stone home and sort of toured through it, and it just struck the right chord, including a kind of jovial opening and then sort of making the way through the house, and she sort of explained why Edward Owens was his name, right? This so-called last American pirate. So anyway, it'll be good to find out. But I've been looking around, and I haven't found it yet. Now I know there's two.
Right, there are two. And I will just say that for those of you listening to the podcast who are really serious Wikipedians, this time, because this generated some controversy last time around, when my students created a faux entry for Edward Owens and then later changed it to explain that it was a hoax, this time around the students created real entries about real historical figures, which they were using as necessary. Every hoax has to have a fair amount of true facts to support the false facts. So there are true facts that they created and put into – they didn't create. They found and put into Wikipedia. They created some entries. And ironically, as will become clear when the hoaxes are revealed, they Wikipedia editors thought that my students were in some way that it was one person who, in Wikipedia terminology, was a sock puppet, because several students created Wikipedia entries and posted them all at around the same time from our classroom. And so somebody decided this meant that it was one person with multiple accounts, the sock puppetry. And so all the entries are going to be deleted from Wikipedia if they haven't already for that reason, even though they happen to be all true. There's some irony.
Wow. Yeah. You know, one of the great like side elements to your lying about the past course is that it kind of reveals the underpinnings of Wikipedia at the same time it does other things.
Yeah. So, you know, Jimmy Wales was actually really ticked at me the last time around. So he can't be mad this time, because the entries that my students put in were 100% true. And one of them actually creates or corrects an error, not in Wikipedia, but at the National Museum of American History. They had something wrong on a card on the wall in one of their displays, and my students noted that, and the Wikipedia entry actually has the correct information. And so that's not one of the ones that's going to be deleted. So that was for the other hoax.
Wow, that's more than I expected about good student work. I'd expected to hear, hey, a proofread essay or something like that, but I guess.
No, I'm bored with that. I want my students to make trouble.
All right.
Mills graduating another class of liars.
Good for you.
And sock puppets.
And sock puppets. That's right. Well, we're going to have Monday, we always do team photos. And so last time around, they were all wearing pirate eye patches. This time around, one of the hoaxes, they had T-shirts made with the banner from their website. And the other one, the sock puppet group, they've all made sock puppets. And so we're all going to – their photo, they'll all be holding up their sock puppets.
That's wonderful. Well, speaking of troublemakers, we are having more or less a themed episode this time, partly taking advantage of Audrey Waters' expertise. We're going to be talking mainly about MOOCs. Massively open online courses. And I thought we'd start off by talking about what Inside Higher Ed has called a proto MOOC, one that's been going on really even before that term has been bruited about. The course itself is Digital Storytelling 106, taught by Jim Groom, notorious troublemaker. And this story, which was reported in Inside Higher Ed and actually even a couple of other places, had to do not only with the course itself, but also with the fact that after a very successful, massively open online course iteration of DS-106, Jim Groom decided to put his course on Kickstarter and raise some funds primarily to get more server space to support the number of people who were participating in this course. Audrey or Mills, do you have any particular thoughts about Jim Groom's success with DS-106?
I think that the class, the DS-106 class, stands in such sort of extraordinary contrast to the other MOOCs that we're seeing become so popularized right now, the Stanford, Udacity, Coursera, MITx model. I mean, I think that, you know, when you think of the history of the MOOC, and in some ways this notion of opening up your class to a network on the web and learning in that connectivist model, DS-106 seems a lot more of that ilk than some of these new and these new classes that we're seeing be launched in recent months.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on that, because I completely agree with Audrey on this. And I will say, Audrey, we have to correct you on one point. If you're going to say it here on the podcast, you have to say you da city. We're just trying really hard to change the pronunciation. But
hey, did you see their new blog? They've got a new blog for you da city, and they've had to point out that students who study on Udacity are called Udacians.
Nah. Okay,
just getting that in.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's good. Yeah. So,
sorry,
and I will say also that there's a certain symmetry to our the earlier comments that we were making about my lying about the past course, because Jim Groom, who I admired tremendously, was one of the hoaxees of The Last American Pirate. And I've always felt a little guilty about that. And so, Jim, if you're listening, I'm still feeling just a little guilty about that. But that in no way colors what I'm about to say about your course. I read the story in Inside of Higher Ed, and I didn't know that this was going on until I read about it. And then I spent some time in the last couple of days looking at it. And this is what MOOCs ought to be. And because my view, I've been very skeptical about these MOOCs right from the beginning, because basically all they're doing is taking an old model of distance education and just opening it up to anybody. And that is putting a whole bunch of content online and telling people to work their way through it, and then they'll know something. And that's, you know, that's essentially taking the correspondence course model from the 1960s, digitizing it, making it, you know, digital also with video and things like that, and then saying, okay, once you've completed all the assignments in the correspondence course, you know something. And I'm really skeptical of that as a teaching model, and have always have been. And so what I especially like about and the article in Inside Higher Ed makes the point that that this is really the instructivist model, and I'm much more interested in learner-centered instruction as opposed to instruction-centered instruction. And so what this course has done, and the way that it has taken advantage of the inherent qualities of the internet, also the sort of decentralized nature of information flow and all of that, I just think it's really marvelous, and I hope that this becomes the model rather than the Stanford, Udacity, whatever models.
It is that, democratization that of DS-106, that radically democratic aspect of it. Sorry, Audrey, that interests me. Yeah, I mean, it's a very different model.
What I was going to say as well, is that you can see that the DS-106 is really about a community of learners, whereas, I mean, and I wrote about this in a post this week on Inside Higher Ed, a lot of these MOOCs, you're very much reminded that you're in a course, the DS-106 is actually a course at University of Mary Washington that students on campus are enrolled in, but it has this sort of larger than life and certainly larger than the classroom, larger than the course existence on the web. It's really of the web and for the web, and not just, oh, we've stuck these materials online and some videos and we expect you to move through the content.
Yeah, see, that was a great post that you wrote, Audrey, specifically about your own experience taking some of these courses with... Are you doing both Coursera and Udacity?
I'm a Udacity dropout, which...
Right. You know, what's fascinating about that is that I'm a no-show in Coursera, that same course you wrote about, CS101. I got tired of waiting for my HCI course that they had promised me with Coursera to start. So I did sign up in the second week for Coursera's CS101 course, and I've literally never showed up. I'm that registered student who just doesn't show up for the whole semester. 3 weeks in, I haven't haven't done a single thing. And I actually, as you wrote, I don't feel all that guilty about it. It's hard to feel any commitment to the course, you know, partly because I'm not paying for it and I don't need the credential. And I think if I tried, I could put together a community of people to take the class with, since I do know a few people who are trying it out. But so far I have not.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm in the same position as you. I have plenty of degrees. I don't need to take the CS101 class for any specific job related or school related purpose. I'm really just genuinely interested in taking an introductory computer science class. But I really feel as though there's certainly a sense that I won't be missed at all. I really am just one of, you know, tens of thousands of bodies that are sort of being herded through this material. Mm-hmm. And it definitely doesn't, it's not an experience that makes you feel part of a community, part of a learning community. It is very isolating. Ironically, even though you're in a class with, you know, thousands of students, it is, you are very much alone.
And to bring it back to Jim Groom's course, what I found to be so interesting about DS-106 is, I mean, so the course itself, the content of the course is very much about the internet as a community and the internet as a medium for storytelling. And I've heard Jim talk about this, and I mean, part of the innate properties of the internet as a medium for storytelling is that it lends itself very well to interactivity, you know, to interactive storytelling. So it isn't just one person telling a story. It's, you know, the storyteller responding to people who are then, you know, engaging with them on the internet. But, you know, Jim is a larger-than-life character. And I love that the course started as sort of a regular course, and then just by opening it up to the internet community and bringing people in with the sheer sort of magnetism of their content, that's how they got people involved. And you're right, it's a very different a different model from what Udacity and Coursera are doing.
I have this question that just to ask the three of you, but has, you know, I've been talking to a few people recently about these new MOOCs, and I keep having this question. I think I raised it on a prior podcast of like why this time is different, you know. And some people I really respect in education, some people, fairly well-known people, I won't mention their names, but you know, people who listen to podcasts will be familiar with who they are, and they're trustworthy, smart people, who think, well, this time is different. That I'm with Mills. I don't quite see even the difference from like a standard by-mail distance learning kind of thing. But they're convinced that there's something new about these new MOOCs, that they're going to succeed where others have failed. And, you know, am I missing something? Could someone, you know, work on the other side for me a little bit to say why it's different this time? Why we think, for instance, that an employer will be excited to hire someone with a certificate from Udacity or Coursera? Why we think that there won't, you know, that the learning outcomes will be any better than they are for things in the past? I don't know. I mean, Audrey, have you explored this? I mean, what are you hearing? Like, what is different? Because I feel like we've been down this road before, and it hasn't worked out well.
I feel like one of the interesting things about the Stanford. The Stanford courses, the Udacity, the MITx, is that these are engineering classes, and that this seems to be, in some ways, a specific set of skills that many people are interested in learning. That's a very different. I mean, this. I don't mean to say that you aren't learning certain skills in Jim Groom's class, or that you wouldn't learn certain skills in a history class or a literature class that would be conducted in the same format. But I think that this is a programming related. Many of these courses are programming related, and there's such a huge interest and demand for that type of material, and not just in this country. I mean, I think that that's the other piece of it as well, is that to me, this seems to be about a global demand for U.S. higher education, particularly in the sciences. And I wonder if that's what's certainly feeding the number of enrollments that we're seeing, whether or not, I mean, I think your point is well taken, whether or not that has much to do with outcomes remains to be seen. But I do think that the demand is definitely connected to people looking for better trained software engineers. And again, not just in this country, I would say India and China in particular.
Right. I mean, it seems like that's a great point about the globalism of it this time, and the brands that something, you know, a university like Stanford can bring, and the brand in general of U.S. education, whatever frailties it might have, it still has a great brand worldwide. But it is weird that not very many people are talking about this the narrowness of some of these early courses in technical skill training in computer science. And even when we say the sciences, I mean, first of all, I have no idea. I should have taken this world history course from Coursera to check it out. But even within the sciences, you know, I think of biology You know, sure, you can learn about a zygote from a textbook or from a an online video or some kind of MOOC. But really, when you get down to the real important stuff, right, what is it that the actual students who are physically at Stanford learn? You know, they're learning about, you know, wet science in a lab and all the little, like, implicit, you know, sort of tacit knowledge that goes into that lab and the access to the professor. You know, I know that the MOOCs have answers to these things, that they say, well, you know, we're doing the, like, basic training and that reduces the cost. But still, at some point, it seems like in some ways it's just done to elevate the value of actually being on campus, that it's like, here's the stuff we can toss out to the world, that it has a kind of charity aspect to it. Perhaps it has a cost reduction for 101 type courses. But even there, you know, I just wonder about how extensive that 101 world is once you get out of computer science.
Well, and I think that the real test of this will be when universities with these brands are then willing to accept, in lieu of their own 101 course, somebody who did the MOOC. You know, if I take Computer Science 101 from Stanford's or Harvard's or MIT's MOOC, and then I say, okay, I'm a new student, I've already done that course. See, I did it through the MOOC. And if they say, oh, yeah, sure, that's great, then it has real,
great point.
Kind of completes that circle that you've just described, Dan. So I think it would be a really interesting test if somebody could present that course to them and say, well, I did it already. I don't have to take it again.
Right. I mean, I think the odds of that are really low, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, in the same way that AP placeouts have come under some skepticism, you know, and those are like actual live in-person classes.
Sure.
Do you think I would agree that, you know, we might not see Harvard or MIT or Stanford accept these classes, even the ones that were taught via MOOCs from their own school. But what about other universities? I mean, do you think that sort of no-name university, middle of nowhere, would accept the quote credit from a Stanford MOOC?
I think the answer is yes, eventually. And I wrote about this, actually. I was going back to my blog the other day. I wrote about this when the book Free came out. I wrote a whole series of by Chris Anderson. I wrote a whole series of posts about sort of the free model in higher ed. And one of the things I said was that it made sense to me that I hadn't heard of MOOCs because nobody was talking about them then, but that things like this, that sort of credentialing, would be a way for students to demonstrate knowledge and skills up to a certain point, whether it was blow out the freshman year, blow out the sophomore year, whatever, that eventually, and then they could move into the sort of more sophisticated things that happen in the junior, senior year and do that on campus. And so I think that's going to happen.
But what happens the first time that a student, because it's all done online, pays somebody $50 like they do, or $300 like they do with the SATs, to take their online MOOC exams, and places out of a year of college, and then gets busted when this is found out and it's splashed across the cover of USA Today. What happens at that point? I don't think there's really a good response to that from the MOOC providers.
Right. And I think that, you know, in the model that I just described, part of the answer for that is a more sophisticated way of assessing students' knowledge and skills than what we currently have. We currently assess that by saying, oh, you completed CS 101, so you know X, which is no assessment of whether the student actually knows X or not. It just means that they have completed that course successfully, and we'll accept it as a transfer credit from anywhere that is institution. We don't know what happened in that class, so we don't know what the student actually knows. We just agree sort of tacitly that we will accept that the student knows those things and has those skills. And so we're going to have to come up with more sophisticated ways of assessing where students are in the learning process. And that exists to a degree already with the CLEP exams that universities have been using forever to assess, you know, what you know through your life.
You know, that's a really interesting point, Mills. And we've alluded to but skipped over the announcement that MIT and Harvard recently made about their own decision to partner in creating a platform to offer these massive online courses. But in the reporting about that joint partnership, one of the things they're emphasizing is the opportunity of these kinds of courses to provide data about what students are learning. Because when you've got people in that kind of online environment, and assuming that they agree to it, you can track, you know, whether they drop out or stay in. You can track, you know, things at a much more granular level than that in terms of what they're doing, how they're doing on tests, and, you know, correlating that to certain account data, all that sort of thing. And that was one aspect of it that I found kind of interesting, is we have such a trend in this country toward trying to assess student learning that it strikes me is at least a rhetorically smart move for these institutions to say, and the private companies as well, Coursera and Udacity. It strikes me as a rhetorically smart move to say that's one of the things that this is for, you know, sort of like a massive research project about online learning.
This is one of the things that fascinated me about this announcement as well, and particularly having taken both the Udacity and Coursera classes, where nobody asked me when I signed up for CS 101 if what my background was at all, whether I'd taken CS classes before, whether I had a degree, what that degree was in, male, female, where I lived, native language, any of those sorts of questions, which I thought was a sort of missed opportunity to do some interesting research about who's taking these classes, who's succeeding in these classes. And I say that in part based on sort of anecdotal evidence from friends, who many of whom took Sebastian Thrun's artificial intelligence class last fall from Stanford, folks who already had sort of PhDs in artificial intelligence were sitting in this class. And so I had the sense that a lot of people were taking these classes that already had a great amount of expertise in the subject matter, and were just sort of sitting in it to sort of see what the class was like. And so I think it makes for a really interesting student population that I haven't seen anybody sort of think about studying so far.
Audrey, let me ask you, how does it work in your experience in terms of forming learning communities in these enormous MOOCs?
I mean, I think so far, for me personally, I'd say it's been really disappointing. In fact, if you see a lot of these, the Coursera and the Udacity, and I'm going to totally say it that way from now on.
The Udacity class.
That really are using a pretty traditional LMS-like interface, and relying on the discussion board, the discussion forums, to generate conversation. And to me, that seems decidedly 1990s, and sort of my earliest and some of my most awful experiences with Blackboard. And so I think, although there are some elements taken from something like Stack Overflow, where, you know, you can vote up interesting questions, you can vote up interesting answers, it does seem as though the community is really based on how much you like participating in internet forums. And again, I'm, you know, sort of not...
I love them. I love them internet forums.
Yeah,
always on them.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm not a sociologist, but I think some people really do like internet forums. And so I think those folks would find... I don't know, community might not be the right word for it, but certainly those folks spend a lot of time participating. And then if you're not a fan of forums, then there isn't a lot of community in the class.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, it just opens up a whole like can of sociological worms. But I mean, I've got to think that the Udacity, gosh, this is just so mean to keep calling it Udacity. Udacity's forums, it's going to be like Reddit. It's going to be like dominated by 19-year-old guys.
It absolutely.
And I can't imagine that's, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what, we haven't talked much about the Harvard MIT thing. But it'll be interesting to see what they do on that front. I have to say, I was a little bit of a cynic on their announcement, particularly when I saw the $60 million number, which, as someone who does a lot of budgeting, I could kind of see right through that number that it was a little bit of a BS number. And actually, I think one of the purposes behind the number was to be a kind of shot across the bow of Udacity and Coursera. To say like we're gonna put a huge amount of money, and it also, I think it's a number that sticks in the professors' minds, so that if you're a professor, if you're a great CS professor at MIT, you'll think about sort of going with your home team rather than switching teams, and you know, leaving MIT for riches with Sebastian Thrun, because hey, they're putting $60 million into it. But if you look at that number, I think not almost all of it, but I would say a majority of it is going to be in-kind labor. They're booking in-kind labor from professors in the creation of these learning modules. And they didn't actually specify a direct funding amount in that press release, unless I missed it. I don't know. Audrey, did you see anything behind those numbers?
No, I didn't.
They just said, you know, we're going to put in $30 million, like pull this number out of a hat. And I'm sure it's, you know, it's 100 courses or 100 professors, and the in-kind labor that, you know, when you're paying professors at Harvard or MIT $150,000 or $200,000 a pop, that's a lot of in-kind labor to create an online course. So I also thought, again, just if I continue on this cynical line of reasoning about edX, I also think this big data play, this notion that, well, we're doing something different, which is we're going to improve learning in our own courses because we'll have all this great data. I also thought this was like a sort of smooth the relations with the faculty kind of a move, where they can say, we're going to help out traditional learning as well because we'll really understand better how to teach Psych 101 because we'll have all this great online data. So I don't know. That's a cynic in me. I didn't quite get what they're going to be doing differently than some of these big classes. But you know, I worry. I think, Audrey, you put your finger on it, that the sociology of it, and even if you looked at Udacity launched a blog this week, we'll link to it from the show notes, even the iconography and the design of that blog, which had a like Star Wars robot and a font straight out of Star Trek, it's, you know, I don't know. Are they really going to have courses in all of the humanities, social sciences, and sciences? It really didn't feel like that. And maybe it's just that this will work really well for, you know, 250,000 student JavaScript course. Maybe that's just where this heads. But I've just heard too many kind of sensible people tell me recently that this seems like the future, and this is going to change faster than we think, and it's going to change across the university. And that's where my kind of cynical skepticism bone starts jiggling.
Well, Dan, let me ask you, why do you think Harvard and MIT in particular are committing so much money and time to this kind of project?
Oh, well, I mean, again, I think it's that if you're an administrator at Harvard or MIT and you just saw Sebastian Thrun leave a tenured job at Stanford for an equity stake in Udacity, and you're looking at your primo faculty, let's say at MIT, most of whom are in engineering, you're not thinking in the back of your mind that some VC or Sebastian or someone at Coursera isn't calling up your star, rising star, you know, professor in computer science to offer them a 1% equity stake in Udacity if they leave to teach Java.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's got to be kind of troubling. And so I think that I think there's a big chunk of this that's just about faculty retention. Hey, you don't need to go anywhere. You can keep your tenure job and you can work part-time at edX, our little in-house thing. And that does the same thing that Udacity does. And maybe we'll give you a cut of that. And, you know, it's nice and comfy and you don't need to move or do anything. And so I think it just, I this is going to sound horrible, I think, to the audience, but I'm just like, with my cynical hat on, I've got to think this is what's going on. Because it just seems a little bit too reactive, considering that, for instance, MIT had open courseware for 10 years now and could have poked in this direction a little further just using that framework.
I think what's interesting to me too is that, I mean, there's certainly the East Coast, West Coast rivalry here. Certainly, you know, what Stanford does, MIT now feel, MIT and Harvard feel they have to respond to. It's interesting that both Udacity and Coursera are for-profit startups, whereas the edX is claiming that it's going to stay in the not-for-profit and be remain affiliated with the universities. So I think that there's some interesting distinction there about the role of venture capital and the role of for-profit enterprises in rethinking, perhaps reshaping higher ed. The other thing that's interesting to me is that MITx is a completely separate part of the university than the open courseware. MIT open courseware. They have no connection whatsoever.
Right. Isn't that a little bit odd? Yeah.
It does strike me as really odd that there's something about that really great legacy and really great collection of materials that the MIT is choosing to go a different direction with MITx.
That is interesting. And I wonder, you know, my own cynical hat has heard far too much about distance learning from various universities. And if I, you know, jammed the cynical hat down over my eyes, I would say, well, a lot of universities are really interested in selling their brand to developing countries, you know, to the Middle East, to Africa, things like that. But then what's interesting is that you get these open courses, and the edX platform is supposed to be open source. And so I am not quite cynical enough to think, well, they're going to lure everybody into this and then start charging for the courses, right? So one of my like pieces of cynicism gets a little bit derailed by this. It's hard to me to think about why Harvard and MIT and even Stanford would want to get involved in this, you know, massive online education sort of thing if you know, there are a number of kind of like latent benefits, like, you know, the brand of the university becomes much more consolidated, or as you were talking about, Dan, there's faculty retention. And of course, there is maybe the notion that, you know, well, we're going to educate the world, which maybe there's some of that in here. But apart from that, it's always hard for me to understand exactly why they would want to do this. But you know, the fact that edX is going to be very different from MIT's existing open courses does, you know, it's suspicious.
Well, one of the things, I mean, and present company not excluded, of course, but I think that professors can be rather egotistical, and I think that the notion of teaching hundreds of thousands of students is really appealing to a lot of mm-hmm. people.
Yeah,
And I think that there is institutional brand at stake, but I think that there's also, and certainly Sebastian Thrun believes this, there's also personal brand at stake. And I think that that's a pretty interesting sell to a lot of teachers, a lot of professors, to be able to say, you know, what's it like to have, you know, tens of thousands of students clamoring to take your class? I think that I don't think we should sort of underestimate the appeal of that.
No, and I think that that's probably a dynamic that's at work in Jim Groom's course as well. Jim Groom is a rock star. He just is, you know, and I think he is a rock star. I'm certainly not immune to that. There was a story actually not too long ago in the Chronicle, too, about another kind of similar endeavor. There's a professor named John Boyer at Virginia Tech who was so popular on campus that he wound up just sort of Ustreaming his courses, which in this case are pretty much just lectures. So, but he, you know, often has, the number quoted in this article is 2,670 students. And it really is just that personal professorial brand that he wound up just using existing internet technologies, none of these $60 million platforms or anything like that, to spread beyond the university. And that course, again, is not one of these computer science courses. This is a course in world regions, which again has innate in the content the sort of notion that you would want to make it global and open it up beyond the university, just like digital storytelling. But there's lots of models for these massive online courses, open or not open. And I think it's something that will be increasingly important in the coming year. Well, I guess we can probably wrap up for now. Any final comments, Audrey and Dan?
Well, I just wanted to underscore something, maybe to bring the conversation full circle back to Jim Groom's DS-106, which I really was glad to hear was crowdfunded, and I pitched in a little bit there too, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners did. But I think that democratization, I mean, the difference there is really striking, that I think a lot of these other MOOCs that we're talking about are about cult of personality, and about the professor as brand. And what's amazing about Jim, as charismatic as he is that with DS-106, what he's done is, in effect, demoted himself, right? He said, I'm just one of the learners. I'm part of the community. And he literally, on DS-106 radio, he hands off the mic, right, to other people. He lets the stream be about the learning community itself. That's something very different than the star professor at MIT or Harvard or Stanford having 100,000 person student course. And I think that's just a real, I think we've sort of pinned it down. This is a big difference in the philosophy here, that, when you hear about people promoting MOOCs and they're saying, well, we don't need a CS101 course in every university. We just need the best professor at Stanford to teach everyone in the world CS101. That's saying something very different, sort of socially, politically, about the university than the model of DS-106. So it really does bring it full circle back to where we started.
Yeah, I would add to that too. One of the big differences, I think, in Jim's class is that the students learn by doing. They learn by making, and they're really participating, as you said, in that community. And in my experiences, at least with the Coursera and Udacity, it feels very much that you're supposed to learn by listening. And learn by listening and maybe some clicking. And I think that learning by doing is this really important piece that is largely absent from what seems to be, at least, the lecture model sort of supersized.
Excellent points. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Audrey.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to have you on. And I actually have been listening to your own podcast as well recently about educational technology. Do you want to give us a URL for that and anything else you're working on these days?
You can find the link to that via Hack Education as well. But yeah, I do a podcast once a week with Steve Hargadon, which has been a lot of fun. Yeah,
that's great. Thank you too, Dan. Mills had to duck out a little bit early to go to some party somewhere. So
yeah, end of the semester parties.
End of the semester parties. It's that time. But thank you for joining us, and thank you in absentia, Mills. And we'll see you, the audience, on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.